from the Sky News Centre at 5, Gary Gliss has been jailed for 16 years for what a judge described as truly appalling historical sex offences against three schoolgirls. One of his victims was under the age of 10, who he attempted to rape after climbing into her bed in 1975. Our reporter Ender Brady was at Southwark Crown Court for sentencing.
On the day of conviction, he swaggered into court with the words, "Let's get this show on the road." He was very belligerent on that day. No behaviour like that today. He could not wait to get out of that dock quick enough.
A Labour government would reduce tax relief on pensions for high earners to pay for a cut in university tuition fees in England. Anna Jones has more. Stop!
There were protests in 2010 when the government said the cap would be trebled to £9,000 a year. Ed Miliband wants it changed.
The next Labour government will reduce tuition fees from £9,000 to £6,000.
After a song was made about Nick Clegg breaking his last election pledge to scrap fees, Mr Miliband insists he'll keep his promise, but these six formers are sceptical.
Heard this old Nick Clegg.
How much can you trust them to do it?
The Chancellor says a lower cap would mean less money for universities.
David Cameron's defending the security services following allegations their actions led to Mohammed Emwazi, the man believed to be Jihadi John, being radicalised. A human rights group says MI5 harassed and interrogated him before he went to Syria to join Islamic State. It's understood Prince Harry's leaving the army later this year. Kensington Palace isn't commenting on the news. It's only issued a short statement saying he's focused on his current role. The price of stamps is going up by a penny next month. From the 30th of March, first class will be 63 pence, while second class will cost 54p. That's the latest. I'm Tom Harrigan.
It's Friday, it's 5 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling, helping me review this week's news. It's the Labour Councillor for South Mead, Jenny Smith. After the 6 o'clock news, George Bush's elder brother Jeb Bush steps forward as the most likely Republican candidate to oppose Democratic Hillary Clinton in the next US presidential elections. So which dynasty will win? Is the American Republic over? Is the USA now just a feudal system, a monarchy in all but name? We look this week at the Bush family's record of collaboration with the Nazis in World War II, and a little-known phenomenon, the tendency for anyone who stands in their way to fall out of the sky and to an early grave. In a mystifying succession of plane crashes, we hear from US Naval Intelligence veteran Kenyon Gibson. Also, the Reverend Stephen Sizer is in the Surrey vicar who the Anglican Church has banned from using social media or talking about the Middle East. Not easy when you're a vicar. He's one of Britain's experts on the mainly US phenomenon known as Christian Zionism. So what is it the Church of England's former oil baron Archbishop Justin Welby doesn't want us to hear? Plus, the 9/11 Commission report didn't even mention the smoking gun of the 9/11 attacks. That's the controlled demolition of Building 7, which wasn't even hit by a plane. Now we hear 28 pages of the 9/11 report were missing. US politicians want them published because they describe the role of the Saudi Arabian government in the attacks. Plus, Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots, one of which this week is Somerset and the Somerset Levels, where this arms cache of 80 weapons was discovered. That's all in the second hour after six. On to our news review in a minute, but Bristol's first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 5 degrees Celsius, wet and windy. This weekend, highs of 10, wet and windy again with some gales on Sunday. Next week, highs of 7 degrees Celsius, sunshine and showers and some brisk winds again. Next weekend, the 7th and the 8th of March, highs of 7 degrees Celsius, sunshine and showers. So cooler, but not quite so windy. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So helping us review this week's news is Labour Councillor South Mead, Jenny Smith. Hi, Jenny. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Hello.
Now, first of all, you're in South Mead as a councillor. Tell us about some of the issues which are coming to you as a councillor and what you do day to day.
We're
trying to actually change where our library is, move it across the road, make it have a cafe, make it alongside lots of other facilities for people in the ward, and that's being discussed through a community plan.
One of the big things, of course, down there is the hospital, isn't it? This brand new hospital. How's that been going?
Well, that's blocking just about every pavement and front drive of everybody in most of the old estate and parts of the other parts of the
But it was always like that, wasn't it? Southmead Hospital, old or new. But at least that there's a new hospital, even if the parking's just as bad.
It was only a little bit in the past. Yes, there was some, but now it's major. And what seems to be happening is staff from places like Wales and Gloucestershire and Birmingham are coming down to work in the hospital and just putting their cars anywhere, all the way around the estate.
But surely there's a multi-storey car park inside, isn't there? There is one,
but it's has, I think it's two floors restricted for the public and one for staff. Can I actually say what it's doing? It's stopping care workers coming in to look after the elderly and disabled who need it. It's stopping people actually getting out of their own front drive, and they're blocking the corners of roads, so you can't actually see if you come out onto Southmead Road or any of the others, and it will cause major accident eventually, although at the moment it seems to be a number of minor ones.
Well, the hospital's doing wonderful things for people outside Southmead, it seems. Have you had a tour around and had a look? What do you make of it?
I've been on about three tours round. It is nice. It's very wonderful. However, it hasn't got enough beds. It's short. We said that from the very, very beginning. They've now said to us, we'll get another 14. Well, that's nothing. That's a trickle. And the facilities are extremely good. But in some cases, some people don't like it because they're in isolation in a room by themselves and without sufficient staff to actually come and bring them their medicines or anything else and to make sure they're safe.
Well, you can't please everyone, can you? Because some people don't actually like being in a massive ward with lots and lots of other people. You know, they see their illness as something more private.
No, I accept that, and we were delighted to hear there were going to be individual rooms. But the best thing that can happen is to have staff check on you regularly. And the staff in that hospital are wonderful and overstretched.
Okay, one little report I've got recently about the hospital. North Bristol Trust are £33 million in debt now, and they failed to account in their financial planning for additional fees for cleaning surgical equipment, storing medical notes for French A to Southmead Park and Ride. They've also been referred to the Secretary of State, who might decide to ask the Trust Development Agency to open up a tender process. But Andrea Young has moved quickly to send the Department of Health a financial report saying they have a 2 to 3 year financial turnaround policy. So £33 million in debt after this PFI, are they going to be able to turn it around?
Well, that's why they're actually getting rid of the Frenchay site. And some of us would like them to address what's happening at Cosham Hospital. And there is an argument about whether we have a walk-in centre at Cosham. But certainly the beds that are provided are a lot less than were provided by the old Southmead Hospital and Frenchay Hospital.
So, I mean, I'm not quite entirely sure who owns this hospital. I think it's the banks now, isn't it? On the PFI, the total debt is £627 million, I suppose shorthand, that's over £600 million, we could say, over 30 years, made up of £430 million construction costs and £170 million on facilities management. The European Investment Bank put up £250 million at the initial stage, but then Lloyds Bank, in partnership with Carillion, put up £627 million, of senior debt equity, which they then had to take out insurance for. Lloyds has acted as the major financial partner, but thought the risks associated were very high, so immediately decided to stay as the lead financier, but to package a financial package to other financial groups. So the Lloyds part reduced as RBS moved in to take up £75 million. Both of those big banks, publicly owned, have been in the news this week reporting their financial figures. The National Australia Bank also is in Southmead to the tune of £51 million, and French Credit Agricole £51 million again. Societe Generale de Belgique, a Belgian bank, another 50 million, which leaves Lloyds with 150 million. Now, this basically is not ours anymore, is it, really, this hospital? Well, it's owned by the banks.
Initially, the main hospital building was built with PFI, but since that time, there's also additional pathology laboratories, there's additional car parks, there are additional buildings. The breast cancer unit is state-of-the-art now and is absolutely beautiful. I went into it about 2 months ago, and the whole site is really one big has been one big building site, and is still in some parts being built on.
And I get the impression that we've got a beautiful looking hospital which isn't actually ours, and that we're servicing a massive debt in order to keep the doors open. Martin, what are your thoughts about these PFIs?
Well, I mean, this is the real problem, isn't it? The state-of-the-art hospital has been bought by the most expensive method you could imagine buying it, and I suppose we're then stuck with the consequences. But, I mean, the fact of the matter is RBS and Lloyds are technically bankrupt. So this is a very, you know, and of course,
hang on, Lloyds have reported a profit this week.
The first time in years. That doesn't mean they've covered all their previous losses, does it? I mean, in actual fact, all of the banks are technically bankrupt if they were to be properly audited, which they haven't been.
And Lloyds have PFI accounts that they're having to clear, aren't they?
Yeah.
So they've had to set money aside for it.
Well, indeed, and I think the whole thing of you bringing the private sector in has been shown to be, in terms of the funding, has been shown to be a ridiculous way to do it. It's the most expensive, long, you know, it shouldn't have happened, frankly. It shouldn't have happened under the Tory government, and it shouldn't have happened under the Labour government, but we're now stuck with it.
I mean, it started under Mrs. Thatcher's government, and it moved on right the way through subsequent governments.
Yes, your Labour government. Anyway, I've been chatting to a campaigner from a group called The People versus PFI, called Joel Benjamin, about these PFIs. So I thought we'd just drill down a little bit into, as we all drive past this wonderful, sparkly new building, let's have a listen to him.
My name is Joel Benjamin. I'm a campaigner with an organisation, People versus PFI. We're looking at the approximately £320 billion of public infrastructure which has been built and financed by largely banks in the City of London. We're interested in the private ownership of public infrastructure assets such as hospitals and schools. It's about £320 billion of public assets which are now owned by principally City of London financial firms, many of them operating offshore tax-free. And the High Street Bank, HSBC, is a major player in that market. And as we've seen in the past week, been a major player in the offshore financial secrecy market, helping rich clients avoid billions of pounds in taxes.
Now, you've just said they're public assets, but actually, if they're owned by HSBC, they're not really public, are they?
Yeah, it's a good point. We all pay for these hospitals, these schools, through our tax revenues. Many people feel it's, you know, an egregious rip-off that banks such as HSBC, Barclays, can then own and operate these assets for their 30, 35 years. In many cases, tax-free, offshore, making huge profits at a taxpayer's expense. And what you tend to find is that the staff in those hospitals, the people who are trying to get care in those hospitals start to, you know, suffer problems like shortage of beds, like shortage of ward nurses and doctors, because the hospitals are spending too much of their budget servicing the PFI contract and the payments to the banks rather than funding frontline care.
So how is it that the public officials have allowed this to happen? Because when we're paying our taxes, we don't want that money to be going to a bank. We want it to go to public services.
Well, unfortunately, what happened with PFI is that the big four banks and accountancy firms such as PricewaterhouseCoopers, PwC, were effectively given license to write their own scheme. They sort of cooked up PFI in the 90s between Australia and the UK. It was then, wheled out by the Conservative government under John Major, massively expanded under New Labour, and effectively it gave the government of the day a convenient way of funding public assets off balance sheet. So by a trick of accounting, what they've actually done is kept the £300 billion of debt off the public books, and so it's kind of flattered the politicians who've been able to build hospitals without the supposedly spending any taxpayer funding up front, but what it actually means is we end up paying, in some cases, 7 or 10 times as much money down the line, because the rate of borrowing from private banks is at least 2 times higher than if the government financed the work themselves. So if you talk to tax accountants such as Richard Brooks, who writes for PFI, nobody in the Treasury can actually tell you if companies like HSBC have actually paid any tax on any of their PFI infrastructure projects. So how this gravy train has been allowed to continue for, you know, almost 25 years is completely beyond most rational people.
There's not a lot of stuff on the TV or the news about it, but where are you online?
If you look for the People versus PFI, .org.uk on our website, and we're also on Twitter and Facebook at People versus PFI on Twitter and the People versus PFI on Facebook. You can sign up for sort of the news digest on PFI issues, and I believe there's some sort of topical problems around the North Bristol PFI hospital. So what we're trying to do at the moment is encourage people to provide as much information on PFI as possible, to send in freedom of information requests into the applicable public bodies to obtain the contracts, and to share that information with campaigners around the country.
Joel Benjamin there from the campaign The People versus PFI. Martin, it's very easy for you to bang your fist on the table and say it should never have been allowed to happen, but how are we going to unravel these massive amounts of public money going towards the banks again rather than towards patient care in the case of Southmead, for example?
Well, the obvious thing to say is when you're in a hole, stop digging. So we've got to stop making these kind of contracts. They've got to be ended. But of course, the real problem is that the banks are insolvent, and the hospitals will also run into problems, and they won't be able to service the contracts. And eventually, of course, we won't just see the banks going down. It'll pull down the hospital system and the various other sectors of the economy with it. And of course, once we get there, all of this stuff about balancing the budget and living within our means, and we all know that you can't spend the credit card, all of that will be shown to be silliness, which it is.
There's another aspect to all of this, and we'll hear from Jenny in a moment. But first, Prime Minister's questions. A question was raised about the idea of shifting health budgets from the Department of Health in Westminster to the regions. Maybe that's going to happen here in Bristol, who knows? But anyway, this week it was announced it's happening in Manchester.
Sir John Leach!
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Does the Prime Minister agree with me that hot on the heels of devolving powers on transport and housing, the welcome announcement that Manchester will take control of its £6 billion NHS budget shows the Coalition's commitment to local decision-making for Manchester, in stark contrast to the Labour government that oversaw the closure of Withington Hospital from Whitehall?
I think my honourable friend is absolutely right to say this is an important breakthrough. It's made possible by our reforms. It's going to help bring the NHS and social care together. The Shadow Health Secretary, who presumably knew absolutely nothing about this, doesn't understand that 8 Labour authorities in Greater Manchester have been talking to us and working with us about how to make this a reality. Yep. What a contrast. People working together to improve the NHS instead of trying to weaponise it across the dispatch box.
Yeah, that's an announcement this week that the health budget will be transferred from Westminster to Manchester. Jenny, what are your thoughts about what that would mean here in Bristol if it was to happen here? Because, I mean, you can see this is a kind of test, and they're thinking about rolling it out in other parts of the country, letting local authorities decide and local health trusts decide how the money's spent rather than Westminster.
Right. Well, what's happened at the moment is because of the general election, the local elections, this has been shelved completely. But we must be aware that some of the authorities would not agree to this. It's obvious that the old Avon is splintered and many would not accept. However, there are advantages and disadvantages, and the disadvantages will be that although it would address cross-boundary flows with services and perhaps mean that we have one major management for the whole of the area and save management costs, at the same time you're still dependent on the amount of finance. And is it sufficient to provide a good service for everybody?
My concern is one of the things we've seen when, as the health authorities have shifted over to become these foundation trusts is the secrecy. Actually, quite a lot of the meetings aren't anywhere near as transparent. So members of the public, union representatives, etc., can't go and sit and witness the way the money's being spent, etc., and scrutinise in that way. So that's possibly what's happening. Obviously, you know, isn't that an aspect here that actually these budgets, some of these budgets, may be becoming more secretive, the way that public money's being spent?
I know that some people under the Freedom of Information are actually accessing some of the information that the health trusts would rather not expose. But at the same time, that has been useful with some of the complaints that's been going into the CCG, because people are
This is the clinical commissioning group,
yes.
And what's your experience of whether they're working or not since the Health and Social Care Act came in, and the idea of GPs being in charge of spending the money? Although when I spoke to my GP about it, he said, I've got absolutely no input into it at all.
Right. Well, I think many of us feel it's marginalised local authorities' impact on what's happening in health. But at the same time, we found that the Bristol CCG told us one thing, and then we went to visit South Gloucester and we went to listen to their meetings, and we heard a slightly different story on some of the issues. So I think that the CCG itself needs to be coordinated right across the area so that they speak with one voice.
Well, what strikes me as odd about this, they're talking about decentralising decision-making to a Manchester super region. And, of course, Jenny's just put in place the problems we'd have in a super region down here, because there isn't a super region. We're like Yugoslavia. Everybody's at daggers drawn. And the point is, the way the health service and the education system is now being run with trust hospitals, academy schools and all the rest of it, local authorities haven't got any control anyway. It is all run from the centre. So what is the Manchester, you know, what power is the Manchester, local authority, whatever it is, going to have over trust hospitals which aren't answerable to them anyway? And the whole point about this is to smokescreen, to cover up the fragmentation of public services. And I think the Labour Party instinct of I can't remember who was speaking about this, is they're not very happy with this, because you could end up with a situation where you live in the country determines the level of care you get. And that's the whole point about having a national health service. There's national planning, national understanding, national funding, and all of this stuff about decentralisation is good, not necessarily. In actual fact, what we learned in World War II, that actually running stuff from the top in a kind of hierarchical fashion can be more efficient than having loads and loads of local decision makers. I mean, the problem for doctors is they're trained as doctors, not as business people. You don't want them sitting there with their four A's at A level and all the things that they've got doing business plans. That's not what we train them for. We train them to be doctors, and they're not supposed to be sitting there making decisions about business. That should be done by administrators on much lower salaries.
And we've already got postcode lotteries.
Exactly.
Where people don't get certain services in other areas. I know that a number of people are really concerned about what's happened in Manchester, because this is going back to the old Manchester before the NHS, when
exactly.
They actually did run all their own hospitals, and they weren't effective and weren't as safe as we would like them.
Okay, well, on to a national story now. One of the big stories of the week is the cash for access scandal. Well, it only took a couple of days after the dispatches programme, which showed both Jack Straw and Sir Malcolm Rifkind offering their services for cash. And there's a general controversy surrounding this, seems to be to do with the idea that MPs have second jobs. Well, I don't know if that's actually a real problem. If an MP wants to have maybe a couple of board meetings every couple of months, doesn't seem to make much difference to me. So how much of time that takes out of them. But anyway, what are your thoughts initially, you first, Jenny, about about this sting, an undercover sting by dispatches, and the main parties telling these people suspending them from their party membership?
As a politician, I'm embarrassed that one of our members of our party was involved in it. But at the same time, I think we must seriously consider whether it's a conflict of interest that some of these MPs have. I mean, it was found, I believe, I read somewhere, allegedly, he has shares in the NHS privatisation. And how can you then sit in Parliament and vote on the NHS service if you are going to make money from the privatisation of that service?
5,000?
Personally, I think that they should have one job and one job to be MPs and perhaps do charity work, but not to actually make lots of money. We're talking about hundreds of thousands of pounds in some cases.
Well, I noticed that Sir Malcolm Rifkin's salary last year from all the various jobs he's got was about almost half a million pounds as a salary. No wonder he's charging £5,000 a day, Martin. The other thing is, of course, he was the chair of the Intelligence and Security Committee. We've discussed that quite a lot of times, which is supposed to do the oversight of the intelligence services, which just really, to me, seems to have no oversight going on whatsoever. I mean, we've just had a story today, haven't we, about MI5 being involved in Jihadi John, if you believe all that story. In many cases, I mean, for example, when Lee Rigby was killed in Woolwich, MI5 was supposed to be looking at making sure that the guys that killed him were under surveillance, and yet they managed to get ammunition, they managed to get weapons and things to kill him. So there were all sorts of problems with the security services, but it doesn't seem like they're getting any oversight, and possibly that's related to the fact that Sir Malcolm Rifkin is working for a consultancy to the arms industry at the same time.
Well, I think there's clearly conflicts of interest, and particularly in his case. But don't forget, Jack Straw was Foreign Secretary as well, so he was a fairly senior figure.
Yeah.
So, you know, we're not talking about backbenchers here. I think there is a fundamental problem. Traditionally, of course, MPs, if you remember, one of the demands of the Chartists was for MPs to be paid, because MPs traditionally weren't paid. They were representatives of the ruling class, and what they did when they went to Parliament was do deals with the other members of the ruling class, and they weren't paid at all. It was a privilege to join and all the rest of it.
Well,
so having MPs paid was the first step to levelling the playing field. But now, of course, what you find is, in US politics in particular, you either go into politics because you're stinking rich and you want to have more power, or you go into politics without much money, but you end up stinking rich, like the Clintons.
Okay.
And that's a very, very unfortunate
I point out that the Labour Party actually last week moved that this as a resolution in Parliament, and that the Tories came out in mass to make sure it was killed off.
Yeah.
And it was discussed by Prime Minister's questions. Again, a pretty lacklustre performance from Ed Miliband. I mean, I do wonder, because he gets six questions, and he seems to be in this really rather lazy habit of asking the same question six times rather than six different questions, which would be much more interesting for those people listening, and actually I think probably more effective in giving people confidence that he's able in some way to think for himself. Anyway, let's have a listen now to the exchange between Ed and Dave over this business of second jobs.
So he's worried about the precise text. He's worried about the precise text of the motion. I'm very happy, by whatever means we can, a manuscript amendment, to insert paid trade union official, and he has the chance, and all of his honourable and right honourable friends tonight in the lobby. This is a very big test. You can vote for two jobs, or you can vote for one. I'll be voting for one job. What will he be voting for?
I think the Leader of the Opposition is absolutely right, and he put this in his letter to me this week, is he says this: the British people need to know that when they vote, they're electing someone who will not be swayed by what they may owe to the interests of others. And I think the biggest problem we have on that front is the fact the trade union movement owned the Labour Party. No more support for trade unions for the Labour Party, then we've got a deal.
Well, I think actually David Cameron won that exchange, Martin. I mean, he's basically saying, well, look, you don't want us to have these fat cat directorships. We don't want you to be full-time or even part-time union officials at the same time.
Well, what I would suggest is we go to the Scandinavian system brought in after World War II, where all political parties are funded by the state, yes, on the basis of their previous support at previous elections.
But we're a million miles away from that now.
Should we be a million miles away? That's how they run Norway, Denmark and Germany. In Germany, the trade unions don't fund the SPD. They say their money for strikes. Maybe we should have that in this country.
And there's a lot of call within my party for that.
What are your thoughts then ultimately? Yes or no to having a directorship, say, where you're spending 3 or 4 hours every 6 or 8 weeks at a board meeting? Is that okay or not?
No. It's not.
Martin?
Basically, no. They've got to do all of their hours. If you were a public servant at any other level, like a civil servant, you would not be allowed to be doing foreigners even 2 hours a week. And that's got to be the principle, hasn't it?
OK, we're going to go to Prime Minister's questions again now. Tony Baldry is talking about the long-term economic plan.
Sir Tony Baldry!
Yeah. It's being so successful, I wonder if my right honourable friend, for the convenience of the House, and particularly for members opposite, could set out the details of our long-term economic plan.
Yeah. Well, I'm grateful to my honourable friend. The plan is about skills, it's about infrastructure, it's about jobs, it's about cutting taxes, but above all, it's about people's livelihoods. It's about securing jobs and livelihoods for people across our country. And the fact that Labour cannot talk about the economy any week when they come to this House is because we've created 1,000 jobs every day this government has been in office. They're keen to talk about second jobs because they don't want to talk about the jobs revolution in our country. They don't want to talk about the apprenticeships. They don't want to talk about the business creation. They don't want to talk about the OECD and the fact that our economy last year grew faster than any other major economy in the West. They can't talk about the economy because they got nothing to say about it.
Well, I mean, what struck me there is he slips that in. The long-term economic plan, which involves cutting taxes. Now, at the moment, the deficit is still far higher than they said that it was going to be when they took power. So at the same time as still
the national debt is climbing, isn't it?
Indeed. And at the same time as suggesting there's no money for anything and everything's got to be cut back, including, for example, local authority spending in Bristol for £90 million over a number of years, there's going to be money for cutting taxes. People still haven't understood, Tony, that the crisis isn't over. It's not over in Britain, it's not over in Greece, it's not over in the United States of America, and the stock market, I see, is at the highest level it's ever been today, and in the US as well. You know what that is?
Well, it's an indication it's all going fine.
No, that's an indication that there's going to be a major crash, and I don't care.
Well, no, the stock market doing well is actually a positive thing. What on earth are you talking about?
That's not what you'll find in the economics departments around the world. Everybody is extremely aware. We had Steve King from Kingston University on here last week. We're actually in the danger zone, really majorly
okay,
in the danger zone.
Okay, would you just explain in a nutshell why when the Financial Times 100 share index is doing so well, the real economy is, according to you, not doing well at all. In fact, doing the opposite, doing really badly.
Well, in a word, the magic ingredient is quantitative easing. And in other words, we've got a kind of an economic recovery in Britain where people are being put onto zero-hours contracts, I'm on one at the moment, so I know what that's about. At the same time, as a property bubble is being blown of enormous proportions. And on that basis, of course, interest rates are at their lowest level for 300-400 years. And on that basis, we've got some kind of growth in the British economy. Meanwhile, the Eurozone is about to go down the toilet, and that will pull down the banking system in Germany, Britain, and in the US. And nobody in the next election is talking seriously about this. Even parties to the left of the Labour, like the SNP, just want to come out with the happy talk. What people really need to hear is that capitalism is actually in a very, very serious mess. And unfortunately, the kind of debate that used to go on in the Labour Party about replacing capitalism has long ago abated, but I'm afraid it needs to be revived.
One of the consequences of all this, of course, is in our cities, there's not a lot of real regeneration going on, and what there is tends to be a kind of privatisation. That is, places like Cabot Circus, which is now all entirely private. And I'm joined on the phone by the author of Ground Control, that's Anna Minton, who was doing a talk in Stokes Croft in Bristol earlier this week. Hi, Anna. Welcome
Hi.
To the Politics Show. Can you just, in a nutshell, can you just sum up what your talk was about and some of the main points you were making there?
Yeah, I was talking about how more and more of our cities are being privatised now, and most new development now follows a template set out by places like Cabot Circus in Bristol, or Liverpool One in Liverpool, or Westfield Stratford Circus in East London, where actually all the streets and public places are privately owned, privately controlled, policed by private security, blanket CCTV coverage. It's creating a very different kind of city and a much less inclusive and free and properly democratic city, because actually all these places have very strict restrictions on rules and behaviour, the kind of activities that are permitted in these places. They don't allow political protest, for example. So it's creating a very different kind of city, and one which sees space primarily as a space for making money, as a space for investment and for raising property prices.
Now, there's, I mean, one advantage is that we don't have to pay the Avon and Somerset to police these places, because these companies will employ their own private security.
Well, I mean, it doesn't really work like that. Actually, private security tend to be there primarily to protect private property rather than to uphold the rule of law. And if there are any serious incidents in these sorts of places, it's not private security who would deal with them. It would be the usual police. Private security don't have the powers to do to deal with proper crime and infringements in crime. My view is that they're a sort of para-police, a kind of extra police, and while they don't have very much impact on what actually happens in places when it comes to crime, I think they do increase the feeling of fear and paranoia among people. I think all this extra security creates a very different sort of atmosphere.
Now, I mean, this is really just a modern version of something that's been going on for hundreds of years, isn't it? I mean, if we go back to, I suppose, before the English Civil War, around the time of the English Civil War, there was a lot of the peasants were being kicked off their land, as happened, for example, in the Highland Clearances and the Irish famines, this kind of thing, later on in the 1800s. Isn't this what we should expect? That, I mean, once upon a time, the earth was a common treasury for all, actually, you know, a free gift to mankind for everyone to use, and now it's always someone's private property, and this is just the latest installment in encroaching private ownership into our public spaces.
Well, I mean, I think for sure history has been a sequence of removal of people from the lands that they live in. You know, there are numerous examples through history where people are evicted and removed from the places that they call home. But I mean, just because this sort of pattern has been seen throughout history, I think it's no less something that should be seriously opposed. And I mean, you know, the Highland Clearances were absolutely dreadful thing, you know, really terrible, which have scarred Scotland, you know, for centuries to come. I mean, you know, just because there are terrible instances of people being deprived of any kind of property rights in history certainly doesn't undermine the case for actually people to have the rights to stay in the places that they call home today.
Just tell us a little bit about your book, Anna, and the title is Ground Control. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, I mean, I called it Ground Control because it's very much about how we're creating places which are much more heavily controlled and where all sorts of behaviours are monitored. And actually, I was speaking in Stokes Croft earlier this week. Stokes Croft is quite the opposite of a sort of place like Cabot Circus, where behaviour is really controlled and a whole host of people are not allowed in there, homeless people, beggars. You know, they wouldn't be welcome in a place like Cabot Circus, even big issue sellers, even buskers. Stokes Croft is a totally different sort of place, which seems to have gone out of its way to be a sort of open and inclusive area which welcomes all sorts of people. And, you know, the presence of all the street art in the area, again, is the sort of polar opposite to the kind of environment that's created in these private places. So my book, Ground Control, focuses very much on the creation of these sorts of places and how they're feeding into this pattern of growing segregation that we're seeing in our towns and cities, where we have these extremes of wealth and poverty literally side by side with each other. And what I'm trying to argue is the sort of city that we're creating today through the excesses of property development, actually that is feeding into our fear of crime and our fear of each other, and how that's leading actually to a less healthy and happy city for us all to live in.
Okay, Anna Minton, author of Ground Control. Subtitle is Fear and Happiness in the 21st Century City. Thanks ever so much for joining us on the Politics Show. Now, I'm also joined in the studio by Jenny Allen, and here is one of the things which is surely going to help Jenny, and that is to actually get more homes built in the city. I think one of the things that annoys everybody is, apart from maybe the people that own them, is the empty office buildings that we go past out today, or the sites which are just covered with rubble, where houses could be, where homes could be for people, maybe three-bedroom, two-bedroom homes. We don't really mind. We just want some decent social housing. So you're part of this campaign, Homes for Britain, and which is arriving in the form of a bus, I think, in Bristol next week. So just tell us what's going on.
Yeah, we're part of the Homes for Britain campaign, which is bringing together the housing sector. It's uniting landlords and homeless charities and house builders and everyone with an interest in making sure that we have the homes that our communities need to raise the profile of this issue, the fact that we aren't building the homes that we need. We've got incredibly high house prices, increasingly high rents in the city of Bristol. We need to be doing more about it. We need a long-term plan to tackle the housing crisis in a generation. We've got Betsy the Bus, who's our Homes for Britain bus. She's coming to Broadmead on the next Tuesday, on the 3rd of March. She's going to be there all day, and we're going to be talking to people about what they think about housing in the city, what are the challenges they face, what are their concerns about housing for themselves or for their children. We've got a petition that we're calling on people to sign, and we're going to be taking that message to London. We've got a massive housing rally taking place in the middle of March. We're going to be taking the messages from Bristol, from the rest of the southwest, over to London to raise with our politicians nationally.
Okay, so I want to hear from you. What do you want to change to make this happen? I mean, we've been screaming about this for years. Most people don't want to pay the massive rents that they have to pay, particularly to live close to the city centre in a private landlord's place. It's absolutely ridiculously expensive. It doesn't bear any relevance to the actual cost of putting a house there in the first place. So what exactly do you want to see change?
Well, I think one of the things we need to change is actually to have people recognise that when they struggle with their housing costs, when they find it difficult to find an affordable place, at the moment, I think a lot of people see that as a personal issue. They see that as something that's connected to them, and they don't necessarily see it as something where local politicians, national politicians, the state has a role. And we think it's really important that this is recognised as something that politicians can and should be acting on. Housing is something, and if you talk to people about their concerns day to day, it increasingly comes up as something that is that concerns them. But we know that in national polls, people don't necessarily talk about housing as an issue. They talk about other things. They talk about their poverty. They talk about things that are actually connected to housing, and housing is perhaps at the root of that, but that's not something they say. So we need people to be raising housing as an issue and to be shouting that, yes, this is something that needs to be done about. There isn't a one thing that we could do to solve the housing crisis. If it was that easy, I think we would have got there. It's a very complex issue. It's taken us a generation to get into this mess. We've had a generation of not building the homes that we need year on year on year. It'll probably take us a generation to get out of this mess, but we need a long-term plan. We've had lots of initiatives and strategies and kind of one-off things from governments of recent years, but what we need is a long-term plan that sets out how we're going to tackle this crisis in a generation.
You know, I can think it's going on in some people's minds out there, in fact many people's minds, is immigration. I mean, we've had figures this week, haven't we, that a massive amount more people coming to Britain than ever before, and of course that puts much more demand on housing. But Martin, it's much more complicated than just immigration. Why is it that and what is the effect on the macroeconomic effect of not building housing, and how has that affected why we're in the situation? Is there some pressure, it seems to me there must be, to actually restrict the supply of housing?
Yeah, well, basically there is. I mean, that's what's happened for a generation. In the 1950s, a Tory government, Macmillan government, was the biggest council house builder of all, because there was a general consensus across the board that it was good for the economy to have lots of good quality, low income housing, because that means that you can stabilise housing costs in the wage bill. People make stable plans about what to do with their lives. And of course, in Germany, for example, they haven't had really big rises in housing prices for years, and that's how you run an effective economy. What we have in Britain is good old British boom and bust, where you get out of university and get on the housing ladder, and then where's your free money? You get your free money, then it goes bust, and then the next generation doesn't even get on the housing ladder. And we're so used to this cycle in this country, especially after a generation of not having any serious commitment to social housing, that we think it's normal. But it's not normal. It's not normal at all. It's actually very peculiar to our economy, and it's one of the main reasons that we don't perform as well economically as we might.
Okay, so to fix it, just simply spend money on housing. And Jenny, what are your thoughts on all this?
Rent control come in.
Rent control.
To control some of the rent levels that are in there. But also, less and less people are owning their own houses, certainly among the young, they're not. which means that they are struggling to survive, paying high rents, but also living in appalling conditions. As a councillor, I see houses with mould and damp, destroying property and clothes, with people suffering from illnesses because of it. So our housing stock in this city is not that good. And what we really need is decent housing built, not gerrymandering, and a standard of home so that people... I think it contributes in some cases to marriages breaking up. It certainly contributes to illnesses in families. And I worked for Shelter for 15 years. I've seen it all. I've condemned houses. I've seen what bad housing does to people, but I've also seen what good housing does to family and knitting communities together.
One of the issues, I mean, Jenny was talking there about other issues that people talk about, and one which we see very much in your face if you're walking around the city centre, at least quite a lot of parts of it, is rough sleeping. And that apparently, according to the Daily Telegraph this week, is up 55% under the coalition government. The number of people sleeping rough in England has increased again last year with an increase of 55% since the coalition was formed. An annual snapshot of statistics released by the Department of Communities and Local Government shows 2,744 people were found to be sleeping rough on any one night in the city's countries. That was checked in autumn last year, Jenny.
Well, I was in charge of the homelessness count for the city of Bristol when we ran it through in the 90s, and we came second to London. But it was because we knew where the homeless were, and I think often the authorities don't look or want to know, or say, well, you're sleeping in a garage, that's okay. No, it's not okay. It's not the place where anyone should be. They should have a decent bed to go home to. And I think we ought to be challenging local authorities right across the country. How are you counting your homeless? Are you actually looking for them? Because some stay in the communities on the edge of cities among people they know in squats or in garages or in some cases in coal bunkers.
Jenny Allen from the South West National Housing Federation. How are we actually going to do something about this? Because at the end of the day, there's a lot of pressure actually to keep the house prices up, isn't there? And not to build enough to satisfy demand. So you've got a problem there.
I think it's very interesting. Whenever you get new developments coming up, I think, you know, Jenny as a councillor will know that you'll get those people that are already satisfactorily housed often being very vocal, and often those people who are worried about housing, those people who don't have somewhere to live, those people who are slightly more on the margins or who are renting, they're the people who we need to get saying yes to homes. We need
I don't know whereabouts your office is, sorry to interrupt you, but I mean in St Paul's there's a massive area, I don't know how many football fields it is, probably 10 or 12 football fields just of rubble, which is owned by, I think, their social landlord places for people, and it's been just like that for years. Why on earth is there not building on those sites like that?
Well, clearly it is important that land is coming forward
it's there, it's just no bricks and mortar going up on it.
There's a lot of things that come together in terms of building homes. I mean, it's not just about the land, it's also about the finances, it's also about the market for those homes. I think a lot of the reasons why some homes haven't been built in the last 5 years, we've had a credit crunch, we've had a lot of people who maybe would have been in the pipeline to becoming a first time buyer haven't been able to, and it's a boom and bust, as Martin said. People, the developers stop building. That's why housing associations and local authorities as building are very key, because it's counter-cyclical. It does help to stop this kind of boom and bust approach and to minimise it slightly. But we are still coming out of that bust. We are coming out of the significantly reduced development that there was in the city. It is picking up, but we still have a lot of sites that aren't yet economically viable, that aren't yet able to be built on. And that is something, you know, clearly the council and housing associations need to be addressing.
Ironic and annoying, but it seems that every new development is another office, you know, and then that just empties people out from existing offices into a new office. Very little in the way of housing.
One of the things that our party is saying is to look at the pension funds, like Avon Pension Fund, and see where there is a possibility to take in that money and plough it into housing, which will give a regular income back once people are paying their rents. In other words, it would be a sound investment eventually for the people with pensions, and I think it's something we should be looking at, because many of the pension funds go up and down at the whim of the stock exchange, rather than have security. And we're thinking, first of all, the people who haven't got a roof over their head and would dearly like to pay rent regularly would be helped, and also to stabilise some of the pension funds that exist.
Back to a story now from last week, and the Telegraph, as you remember, we had a story about HSBC and the resignation of Peter Oborne as their chief political correspondent over their lack of coverage of HSBC. And something which popped up, I think it was just on the Friday, which I managed to miss last week, was that the Daily Telegraph's owners, the Barclay twins, actually have a £250 million loan with HSBC. So this might be possibly one of the reasons why why they were a bit reluctant to have articles in their Daily Telegraph newspaper which are critical of HSBC.
Gee, you think? You're a very cynical man, Tony. I don't think like that.
Tell us a little bit about the Barclay twins, because you and I actually visited them, didn't you? Well, not actually in their castle in the Channel Islands, but yeah.
But we went to Sark, because in Sark itself, which is not actually part
they
of...
They live at a place called Brecu, which is a tiny island,
it's a tiny island of Sark. And they've tried to make Brecu independent of Sark. But Sark refused to let them. Sark's only a small country. It has 600 members, 600 citizens. And the Barclay brothers are trying to take it over. And they've been bullying the locals tremendously. And so when they had an election in Sark to chief police a couple of years ago, the Barclay brothers wanted to put their supporters in as on the local council, as it were, and none of them were elected because basically the locals don't want them there. And therefore they then sacked all of the people they employed on the island, because what they're trying to do is buy up the island and turn it into a kind of, you know, a sort of a tourist paradise for the super wealthy. And of course the locals who live on Sark and who've lived there for generations don't take very kindly to this at all. And when we went out, it was before the last election, the Barclay brothers got hold of all the MP's expenses hard drive via a theft from the House of Commons. This is what most people don't realise. Cameron flew out there to talk to the Barclay brothers about what they were going to do with all this info, and we got that from the people in Sark. And of course, what he did is certain politicians had their expenses exposed and were driven out of politics. Other politicians who were helpful to the status quo and to those with the power didn't have their expenses put in the public domain. So, for example, Tony Blair's expenses must have been on that hard drive, must have been, because they were all on. But have we heard anything about Tony's expenses? Not a whisper. Because the Barclay brothers, the Barclay brothers owe him a few favours.
This is amazing.
What Cameron did, it seems, is he got rid of various people in the Tory party he wanted to get rid of as part of his own coup d'etat, as it were, within the Tory party.
Well, as being a sort of representative for the City of London, people who might have been critical. What are your thoughts? I mean, this is the London press we're talking about here. Incredible backstabbing goes on up there. What about locally? What's your thoughts about whether or not the press here in Bristol is doing a good enough job?
Oh, I don't think the press in Bristol represents what most people are caring about nowadays. And certainly I, as a politician, rarely get into the press. In fact, some of us have thought it's pointless anymore to get the Evening Post.
Well,
to
I can tell you, somebody I do
letters.
See is George Ferguson. He's in there quite a lot.
Yes. And
in the Bristol Post, obviously.
Yes, obviously, they think George Ferguson's wonderful.
I was on
on the doorstep, that's not the message we're getting.
I was on the Post website the other day, looking for the politics section, clicked on politics, and it just says page not found, no politics. The other thing we were discussing last week was the demise of Bristol 24/7, which has now been taken over by Mike Bennett and Dougal Templeton as the publishers. And the guy that set it up, who used to be chief sub at the Western Daily Press and took redundancy, ploughed the money into starting this little independent news website, was forced into a position where he had to resign by having someone who's a kind of cafe editor put in as editor above him. Just to relate some of the stuff that's been going on with Bristol 24/7 is, I mean, it's not very good if you're the news editor to be getting texts off of the publishers saying, go easy on George Ferguson, we've got to keep him sweet, this kind of thing. It's not going to give you real independence as an editor, is it, Jenny?
No, and any politician, you should feel there should be the strength by the public to challenge us. The public often have bright ideas, good ideas that we should adopt. And if you're actually getting only one person's ideas going forward, then you will end up with a controlled authority with very little advancement into the future.
So what about this idea of potentially having a referendum in the city to say we don't want a mayor anymore, we would like to go back to the old system?
Well, that was almost 100% by every political party in the city, that we would hand that vote back to the electorate. In other words, ask the people in Bristol, do you want a mayor's system to continue?
So what real difference has it made, having a mayor? And the difference over the years, because you've seen quite a bit of both sides.
Oh, there's been dramatic changes in the way he has to sign everything off. So when councillors say we would like, we have to wait to see whether he will acknowledge that he's going to allow it to be done. And even then, with some of the things, Eastern swimming pool, I heard, although we passed it on council, although he signed it off, I'm being told it's a matter of possible, not certainty, which is worrying. In the old days, when you had council committees and cabinet members, you actually knew where you were going with the finances. We find that officers more often decide the finances of the city, and then we're allowed to tinker with some of it.
OK, another story now. A suicide expert claims he was censored. This is in the Independent. The government's expert on suicide prevention pulled out yesterday. That is Tuesday's Independent. So imagine that was Monday. From giving a Ministry of Justice presentation on rising suicide rates in custody, claiming he'd been told not to mention a possible link with falling prison staff numbers. Professor Louis Appleby, who leads the National Suicide Prevention Strategy for England, tweeted that he'd pulled out after being told not to refer to falling staff numbers. Professor Appleby, a psychiatry professor at Manchester University, declined to comment. He later tweeted he'd received an apology from the National Offender Management Service and an assurance that no subject, including staffing, is off limits.
Well, I mean, they want to hide the fact that we're talking about the long-term economic plan earlier and the cutting of taxes for the wealthy, because I presume that's what he meant. Meanwhile, of course, the reality is that the bottom line of broken Britain, people are on the breadline and some of them on the lifeline.
I mean, some people, for example, some staff, Jenny, working in prisons have said that they've just had to take redundancy or resign and leave because they don't feel the prisons are safe anymore.
No,
to work in.
I don't think they're safe for the staff or for the people that are in there. And we know that some of the people that are in prison are actually mentally ill and shouldn't be there in the first place. But then we're also being told that on the 23rd of February in The Guardian, it's telling us that psychiatric wards failing and leading to suicides. Suicide rates are going up. And we have to ask ourselves, when people find it is impossible to continue living.
Okay, answer me this one then. Since the council tax in this city is going up, how come all we're getting is service cuts, cuts, cuts?
Well, if we didn't hadn't put the council tax up, then you would have lost even more services. I mean, I was told recently that we had 38 vacancies for jobs in housing, and that housing departments are struggling to actually maintain a service to be proud of, and they can't actually do that.
Okay.
There are vacancies everywhere in the authority.
Okay, thanks to this week's guest. That was Labour councillor for Southmead, Jenny Smith. Time for the Murdoch News at 6. After the news, this mysterious arms cache of 80 weapons discovered in the Somerset Levels.